Welcome to Filmstrip, movie reviews presented by Continuous Play Podcast. These podcasts are spoiler-filled as we discuss the plots, characters, and themes of the films in review. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.
Welcome to Filmstrip. I'm Jay.
I'm Ron.
Today we're excited to announce a very special guest co-host, Justin, from the Generation Y and Peripheral Podcast.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
How you doing tonight, Justin?
I'm doing great.
We are doing great. Justin, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and your shows.
I've been doing the Generation Y podcast, which is a true crime podcast, since 2012. So I've been around a while. That's like pre-serial when, you know, everybody started doing a true crime podcast. So, and during the Generation Y, since we cover so many, you know, horrible things in society, you always brush upon mental illness, sexual assault, drug addiction, all these things that you really don't have time to really talk about when you're trying to tell a story. So I started another podcast called The Peripheral, where I interview folks about those type of topics. So they kind of go hand in hand, I think.
Very cool. I've been a listener of the Generation Y since the early days. I think I came in around episode 4 or 5 and have have stuck in. So I've been around a long time. Yeah, we've been doing this one. Filmstrip, in one way or another, has existed since 2010. Ron's been with us for the last 2 or 3 years and came in on a set of Golden Globus notes that we've never forgotten. So, I've been listening to your show for a while now. Ron's wife's a big fan. So.
Nice.
My wife Holly has a Generation Y t-shirt that she was wearing just the other day.
How you doing tonight, Holly?
Well, Justin, you and I had been talking online through Twitter and things, and I decided that in 2017 I was going to just reach out to different people to have different guests on the show, and yours was like one of the big ones. I was like, if I can get one of the Generation Y guys, if I can get Justin in especially, this will be a really fun thing. So we've been kicking around for a while, and you picked out the movie we're going to do tonight, and I'll tell everybody we're reviewing John Carpenter's The Thing, and I'll get into the usual preamble in a bit, but you had kicked that to me, and I said, yeah, absolutely, and Ron got involved in this because Ron and I have this thing where, with our other friend Nick, we will review some of the like worst things ever put on cinema all. And I remember one day Ron sent me a note and said, I really want to do The Thing because I need to do something good for once. and we just released, as we're recording this, is the day we released the show for The Sand, Blood Sand. Anybody that's listened to that show knows what we're talking about. And I saved the note that Ron sent me. He said, man, The Thing is going to look even more awesome after The Sand. I said, how could it not?
It's all one of my all-time favorite horror movies. I mean, it's up in my top 5 for sure. So it's a great choice.
Well, fantastic. We'll get to the background in a second. So, of course, we're talking about The Thing, starring Kurt Russell, Wilford Brimley, Keith David, Richard Mouser, T.K. Carter, and Donald Moffat, directed by John Carpenter, as I said, released in 1982 on a budget of $15 million, grossed over $19 million at the box office, but was not considered a success. In fact, Carpenter will tell you that this cost him another job shortly thereafter, the fact that it wasn't a hit. And up until recently, he used to get really mad when people tell him they loved it, because he said, where were you in 1982? When I needed you. So you mentioned, Justin, this is one of your favorite things, though, no pun intended, and one of your favorite films. So when did you first get exposed to it?
I mean, I'm 40 years old now. So in 1982, I was a little kid. So I couldn't be there to support John then. But it was, I'm sure I was in my late teens by the time I heard it, which was probably, you know, 1988 to 1990 is when I finally saw it. And it was, you know, back in the days of Phantasm and, Exorcist and what have you. So, first time I saw it, the special effects just blew me away. And I had no idea what I was watching. So that's what really grab me because I'm one of those anti-CGI guys.
Wisely. I got into this because of Halloween. I've told this story on the Halloween retrospective we did a couple of years back, but long story short, I ended up seeing Halloween at a much younger age than I probably should have, but with my parents involved. So my dad, though, was a big sci-fi guy, and he loved the film Alien. So right after I saw Halloween, he showed me Alien, which I was just, you know, blown away by. And then he said, okay, now you got to see The Thing. But he actually got me to watch The Thing from Another World before I saw the John Carpenter thing, because I'd seen it on the television scenes in Halloween, and I wondered what that was. And he said, oh, you got to see that one and then see The Thing. So I saw this at a very young age, and I don't think I got it at all. I'm pretty sure I didn't, actually. And it wasn't until very late teens that I went back to it and watched it again. And it's been a while since I'd watched it before we decided to talk about it here. So, Ron, what about you with The Thing?
Well, I worked in a video store for part of the 90s, and it was always one of the more popular boxes. So I probably got introduced to it through probably one of those like 100 scariest movie moment type of things that they were doing in the late 90s. I really didn't check it out like you guys until I was already, you know, into adulthood. Mostly because I think when I was young, I caught the blood test scene on TV and just noped right out of the movie for a good solid 5 years after that.
That was just it, right? So
yeah. Just the screaming blood was all I needed to. I couldn't hit it.
I remember when, you know, the scene happens, we'll talk about it later, where the guy's arms get clamped off when he's trying to revive the person that's down. And I've never forgotten that scene at all. So what about the original, though, and then even the 2011 prequel? Have either of you seen those?
I've seen both. It's been a long time since I've seen the original. But I remember that they were always going through rooms and opening doors, and you never knew when the alien would be on the other side of the door to grab a hold of them. And in the beginning of the 1982, The Thing, in the beginning of the film, they have the game show where they're like, what's behind door number one? What's behind door number two? And I thought that was sort of a nod to the original.
Oh, I'd recall that. That's great. So.
Yeah. And then the new thing, I liked the storyline. I actually didn't mind the characters, but the CGI just ruined it for me. And I'm not going to cuss right now because I don't know if you feel out cussing on your podcast.
Yeah, we allow, depending on the rating of the film, so you can go as much as you want.
It was horrible. It ruined the movie, and I hated it. And another reason why I hated it was they actually, in the John Carpenter's The Thing, one of the scenes where the helicopter comes and lands at their fort, they originally had the helicopter flying over a mountain and blowing up, and then the guy coming over and shooting people. But they thought, well, that's too contrived to have the explosion on the other side of the mountain. And then in the remake of The Thing, that's exactly what they did.
Yeah, so, which makes no sense at all. So.
Yeah, I just, yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, I'd seen the original one, and I saw the 2011 when it came out in theaters because I thought, you know what, this is a bold idea. Anytime you're going to do a prequel where you're telling me we're going to end right where the other one begins, I'm already intrigued to see if, one, you can pull that off, and two, can you tell anything? And I thought the story was fine and the execution was okay. It just kind of left me flat. Like, when I walked out of it, I said, I really want to go watch the 1982 thing now. And I don't think I've ever seen the 2011 again until we were watching, you know, getting ready for this, and I watched it again. But I watched it once and was just sort of done with it.
What did you think, Ron?
Yeah, I actually watched The Thing from Another World probably 2 years ago, and then I did a live blog of it for a long defunct horror movie website I had with a friend of mine during one of those PCM like nights of horror or whatever that they do around October. And I actually I tried to look it up today and I couldn't find out for sure one way or the other, but I thought I actually reviewed the 2011 one for Den of Geek, but I really am not 100% on that, because at this point I've been there for probably 10 years now-ish, close to it, and I've lost track of all the things I've done today.
I was going to say, the memory of that review has got to be buried under a Walking Dead or a Game of Thrones episode somewhere, man. I mean, your writing is prolific. So, yeah, I love, just talk about thinking from another world for a minute. I love those kind of 50s monster films, like, or horror films or scary films. Like, you know, The Invasion of Body Snatchers, the original one's one of my favorites. I even went back and rewatched the Michael Landon I Was a Teenage Werewolf when Brian and I reviewed Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. And I will dare anyone, if you will watch that Michael Landon movie and then watch Nightmare 2, you'll understand that movie a lot better, because they're the same thing. So, but exactly. Yeah, but I love that kind of stuff. I've always loved the 50s, and particularly the ones that were rooted in the Red Scare and stuff like that. They're such a politics of their time, you know, and I've been a big fan of that. But I want to ask both of you where you are on John Carpenter films in general, because I will say now, I'm a John Carpenter apologist, and I will say that there's some of the stuff he's made that's not as good as the other, but I like his stuff in general, even when, you know, it's become kind of fun to bash him.
I want to hear Ron's answer first.
Oh, I think I'm a huge John Carpenter apologist too. I think he's great. Even the stuff that isn't very good, like, you know, Ghosts of Mars is still kind of interesting. I even watched what was the one he did for, I even watched that cigarette burn thing I think he directed for Masters of Horror.
So
and I've actually have been looking at live tour dates, thinking about making a trip up to Chicago to watch him play movie themes live. So you could say I'm kind of a fan.
His theme songs and stuff, like, that's great driving music. I'll put that out there for anybody.
The Lost Themes album?
Yes, absolutely.
Which is weird that he didn't do the music for this one, but I guess if you can get Ennio Morricone, you kind of have to.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I'll still make an argument, he had a lot to do with it. But
I love all his early stuff. You know, this is sort of a kind of Metallica sort of deal. I liked everything up until Justice for All, and then after that I could just do without it. And with John Carpenter, it's kind of the same. His old stuff is impeccable. It's perfect. And I don't know what went wrong. I don't know with Ghost of Mars. I have to say that John Carpenter always has that theme of, you have something evil, you have a monster, you have whatever, and superior firepower is what takes it out. But in Ghost of Mars, it was just over the top. It was like almost a caricature of his normal sort of theme. So it lost it for me.
I feel like that one somewhere or another got away from him along the lines. But, like, I mean, you look at, you know, Chris, Halloween's obvious, right? But, like, even The Fog, which the remake of that's rather dreadful, but when you go back and watch that 1981, it's not half bad. It's kind of ridiculous, but It sort of works as, like, the most serious Scooby-Doo story ever made. You know, it's kind of on that level. Then Escape from New York's great. Christine is what I think is one of the best Stephen King adaptations ever done. And that still works as a film. And then, I mean, even you get into stuff, though, like They Live. I mean, how can you not love that? I rewatched In the Mouth of Madness recently. I don't know if you guys have seen that one lately, but that's one that I would hold up that says works pretty good still, too. So,
I mean, and when did Ghosts of Mars come out? That was like a 1990s film, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So everything in the 80s he did, I top 10 stuff, man. I loved it.
Yeah. Ghosts of Mars was 2001. I'm going to say that his end point kind of, for in terms of being quality, would be John Carpenter's Vampires.
Which, yeah,
I think is ridiculous, but and a lot of fun. Mostly for James Woods, but I can see that it's definitely even a step down even from like Escape from LA.
Yeah, that one's definitely on the lesser end, and it's not one that I would go back and revisit often. But again, you know, the man's got a touch with it, and I think the thing about Carpenter films, the ones that work the best, are the ones that have that central theme of evil again, but they're also very minimalist in nature. Like, the story's really simple. Like, we go through the plot summary here in a minute. The story of this is really simple when you boil it down. It's all in the interaction and what you think you see or what you think you hear, and then the guessing game that he sets up in this movie. And this is all just a big whodunit. And, you know, old Agatha Christie stories, you know, that's what they're all built on, is that simple tenet. And I think he's a master of understanding that. So we've gone into it a good bit here. Ron, I'm going to throw it to you. Give us a plot summary for The Thing for anybody that maybe hasn't seen it in a while.
A 12-man research team at a remote Antarctic research station discovers an alien buried in the snow and ice. Once unfrozen, the shape-shifting creature wreaks havoc, creates terror, and begins killing the team one by one. Helicopter pilot McReady tries various methods to determine which of the remaining crew is actually the alien being in disguise. McReady speculates and intends to hibernate until a rescue team arrives. He and the remaining few decide to dynamite the complex, but as they set up the explosives, the alien monster transforms into something much larger and attacks. McReady triggers the blast with a stick of dynamite, which destroys the base. As he sits nearby while the camp burns, team member Childs reappears, claiming he was lost in the storm. Exhausted and with no hope of survival, they acknowledge the futility of their distrust for whether or not one of them is the alien, and share a bottle of bad scotch as the snow falls and fire slowly burns.
How do you know it was bad scotch?
It's J&B. That's the official Scotch is Giallo movie. It's awful.
That is true. So they, also a college memory, sad to say. But lots of places we could start here with this, but the three things that really stood out to me, I was kind of looking at this film and I started thinking about it, was there's really like three big things Carpenter's into with this, and it's survival, masculinity, and suspicion. And those three things seem to kind of circle each other around this plot and around all of these characters and how things go. And for me, the thing that really works in this film is the fact that you don't have anybody here that's such a big star and so recognizable that they dominate the screen. Like, Russell's obviously probably the biggest star out of any of them, but at this point in time, nobody would have really known that, I don't think. And even now, when you look at him, he's always best when he's unassuming in some ways, at least to me. So to me, like, the ensemble here, and to have it be all men, is a real gamble, because that's, it's not like Carpenter can't write women. It's not like he's not, you know, Kubrick or something. He doesn't know what to do with them. Like, he can write good female roles. I mean, he, you know, Laurie Strode is the pre-runner to something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and stuff like that. So he obviously knows how to do that. The fact that he decided to do this as a project of, you know, an exercise of understanding masculinity, and then in the context of survival and suspicion, is something that's really stuck with me about the film. Is the three things I saw, at least. I'd throw it to you guys. Do you see the same things?
Yeah, I think so. I thought it was a little odd that it was all male cast, but I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't. It's only now that I go back and think about it, I think, yeah, it's a little ballsy.
Yeah, that's that seems to be like a recurring theme in a lot of John Carpenter's movies, especially his early work. Because you've got, I mean, even like from Assault on Precinct 13 on, it's been, survival has been one of his main, essentially one of his main motifs. Escape from New York does delve kind of into the masculinity, because you've got the ultra cool, you know, Snake Plissken. So yeah, that's some interesting theory you got there, Jay.
I mean, it's just, just stuff that I've seen, and it makes for interesting discussion, though, because again, when you've got these men in this isolated, like the most isolated place you could think of on the planet, right? And they're there to just do work. And the one of them that's like the most macho of all is the one who's the non-scientist, McReady. He's just the pilot, you know. So he's there, and he's obviously a heady guy, because he tries to play computer chess and he gets mad at it and pours a scotch on it, which, that's an expensive I mean, it's one thing to break a controller, but holy cow, you know, can you imagine? Yeah. But to watch him sort of against the other characters here, and particularly the scientists and the base chief and stuff, I don't know, I just find the interplay between all of them very interesting. And I feel about this film a little bit the way I feel about Blade Runner, is that I don't know if, like, the first time through you really get all the layers of it necessarily. And unlike Blade Runner, I don't think it's so hidden that you have to like beat your head against it to maybe figure it out. I think this one reveals itself over time, but it does take some peeling back.
Yeah. And Blade Runner came out the same year, didn't it?
Yeah, like right at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why they say the thing didn't make as much money as they were expecting, because Blade Runner came out, I think, the same week and was number two. And the thing was number eight at the box office.
Mm. What? I mean, I thought it was a great flick. And even for 80s horror, it was pretty well done. I know that John Carpenter's criticized it for, the soundtrack, the score, even almost got a Razzie Award. And he hated the poster because he thought it looked like a slasher film. And he just nitpicks this movie to the point where I'm like, what? What's wrong with this movie? It's so good. The paranoia, the inner party conflict is perfect. It's believable. And all the characters are believable. I mean, that's what carries the movie, are the characters. It's not even really the story after a while.
Do you think I'm just going to throw this out there. Do you think John Carpenter nitpicks this movie so much because whatever project he lost because of the thing's lack of success was something he really wanted to do?
Yeah, I think so. I think the fact that it didn't do well and got him fired ticks him off. And, you know, and I think it did at one time. Like I say, the more recent years, he's softened on it a bit. I mean, the man is in his 70s now, so he is starting to soften a little bit, even for John Carpenter, who's, you know, the man, it maybe weighs 110 pounds, and he's made out of half Marlboro and half, you know, scotch. I mean, the man is just grizzled. But he softened on it a little bit, but for a long time, it did make him mad, and I can understand that. It's like if, I don't know, it's like if you start to talk to Aerosmith about one of the records they don't remember recording. You know, like, they're like, well, I can't really help you with that, you know, so they don't have any real affinity for it.
I just looked it up. The thing he lost out the opportunity to do was Firestarter, and he'd already picked Richard Dreyfuss to be the lead. He had two guys working on the script. Like, he was set up to just go right into Firestarter from this. And when this wasn't successful, they dropped him off of Firestarter.
Wow, can you imagine Firestarter if he had done it? That would, wow.
Yeah, better movie.
Yeah, much better.
Yeah.
Because that movie is not good. So.
I liked it when I first saw it, but at the same time, I was thinking about movies like Scanners, and Firestarter just wasn't quite edgy enough.
Yeah, Scanners holds up. Firestarter, not so much. So that one shot of Drew Barrymore's hair kind of flying with the barn on fire still looks cool, but everything else in that movie is, you know, it's been done before and done better. But
well, when it comes to him getting fired from Firestarter, definitely that would have been a completely different movie, and that might I guess soil his view. But if you make something and you know in your heart that it's brilliant, it's good, I don't know why you would ever I guess question your own ability. And I don't know why he would think this wasn't a good movie. I mean, sure, it was a flop in the box office, but since then, it's become this cult classic.
Oh, and yeah. I think it's even gotten above cult at this point. It's become really mainstream. I mean, they made a remake of it because it had so much buzz for so many years. And that's what got the prequel remake even started, was people were like, man, with all we ever hear about in sci-fi communities is The Thing, maybe we should go back to that. And, you know, they weren't wrong. I mean, it wasn't a bad idea. So I think, too, I find it interesting that he doesn't like the score on this. And I think that's completely because he didn't necessarily have the entire hand in it. But for years, I didn't know this wasn't a John Carpenter score. I mean, it feels just like all of his scores.
I know, right?
Yeah.
I think it's because he went for, Morricone had a bunch of different ideas already out there. And John Carpenter picked the one that sounded the most like a John Carpenter score, because from my understanding was there was like a more traditional score, and then there was like the electronic score that we got in the movie. And so of the options that were offered, John Carpenter went with the one that felt the most like a John Carpenter score. But I think it's just like different enough that it rankles the you know, the curmudgeon in him.
Yeah. The thing is, though, I can't imagine this film with an orchestral score, what it would feel like. Like, the minimalist sort of thumping of those, you know, Wurlitzers and all that, you know, automated drum machines and programming and stuff, which at the time was, you know, still really cutting edge and took five people to do, you know, to make that work. Now you can just do it on your laptop, right? But back in those days, this took something to pull off. And the way it builds to the ominous of all of this, because this thing about this movie is it's in like this stark white place. I mean, it's bright for so much of the time. And yet those scenes are just as scary as when they're in the dark with it. Mm-hmm. And that's what gets me about this is, you know, so much of Halloween works because it's all about lights and shadows and Dean Cundey in the dark, right? But this movie it's bright and it's right there in front of you. And it's the truly alien nature of it and the way it just comes out of nowhere sometimes, I think really gets the goat in this film.
Exactly. There's, you know, the one scene in the film when he says, "You're not all attacking me right now, so I know you're not all turned yet." And it's like out in the open, but, you know, hiding in plain sight. And so it doesn't matter if it's daylight or night.
I want to ask y'all about the thing, too, just the alien itself for a minute here. MacReady, you know, has this whole idea that, you know, all it's going to do is hibernate and it's going to try to get to population. But what do you think the end game for this creature is exactly?
It's a virus. It's just replicating. That's what viruses do. They just keep replicating their cells, and that's what it's doing to its victims. It's just taking over their cells and then imitating it.
I mean, we kind of see it later with the blood test. It's not really sentient, I don't think. I think it is. It can mimic sentience, but I don't think it is capable of some kind of great plan. I think it's just a thing that is driven to spread itself and to survive.
Yeah, see, you hit the word that I like, the survive word. It's instead of having a purpose or a bent of like Michael Myers or the gang in Assault Precinct on 13, you know, all of that kind of stuff. It doesn't have a motive necessarily other than just to live. And I think that's why, and because I saw them together too, but I've always sort of equated this movie and the original Alien sort of together in that same pile, because that original xenomorph is just trying to survive in a hostile environment to itself. The fact that it has to kill all the crew is because they're threatening it in a lot of ways. I'm not picking up for the alien, but I mean, that's kind of what it sounds like I'm doing, right? But the thing, what we learn here, and this is a pickup from the 1950s movie, is that the Norwegian crew found the thing and they blasted its ship out of thermite, right? Or with thermite, they blasted it out of the ice. So they basically woke it up. And along with Captain America, and then all, you know, everything broke loose from there. So it is a virus. That's a great way to describe it, Justin, is that it's very much a virus.
But it still does have somewhat of, I guess, wisdom or a plan, because it knows when to expose itself and when not to. So it does have some logic there.
Yeah, but I think I think a lot of that is based off of the situation that it finds itself in. I think it's kind of like, you know, you don't know you're sick until your body is overcome with whatever illness you have.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
You can kind of feel it catching up on you, and then all of a sudden you're sneezing and water eyes and blowing your nose and all that good stuff. So I think it was a situation where, like we saw closer to the end, when Wilfred Brimley comes back and smashes his hand on that guy's face, that that's when it became, all right, so now we're on even footing. We can be more open about what we are. We can be more active, because it's not me and, you know, 11. It's not me, the monster, and 11 other people. It's two of us and two of them, or two of me and two of them, I guess.
Right. You know, I never thought about it till you just said that, Ron, but this feels like part of the influence for the Vincent D'Onofrio bug in the original Men in Black. It's kind of the same motivation.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, what on earth were these research people doing out there with grenades and flamethrowers.
Yeah, okay, you hit on one thing I was going to ask is, look, I'm a big nerd, so I always looked up what the real job was of the movie I was watching or whatever. And I remember reading for years, I've read about the Antarctic expeditions and stuff, and they're not soldiers. They don't have M16s and pineapple grenades. They don't have any of that stuff. Like, the fact that they have thermite just to use is kind of amazing when you think about it. Like, I don't know what the idea of you would have to have some kind of small arms. I get it, maybe to hunt or to defend yourself from, you know, polar bear or something like that, maybe. But like, you don't need an arsenal out there.
No.
Well, you need an arsenal because you know who else is on Antarctica? The Soviets.
That's
what if they start acting up?
I forgot that we are in the Cold War. You're right. But why would the Norwegians have weapons, though? I thought they were strictly neutral.
Apparently, they have grenades and thermite.
I know, right? Pretty good stuff, too. But the guy's a lousy shot, though. He can't hit that helmet for anything. But
I know. Like, and my other beef that I have to take here is every time there's a fire, they're like Johnny on the spot with those, you know, fire extinguishers. I'm like, let it burn a little longer, please.
I kind of got the sense, though, that like a fire in a small quarter situation like that could be really detrimental to whatever else they were doing. So they were probably all fire drilled, you know, out of their mind.
I guess so, because I mean, even the Norwegian helicopter, when it blows up in the beginning, like they're out there like putting it out. I'm like, dude, it exploded. There's no survivors. Just stand around and get warm. Just, you know.
They do have some great parkas, though. I mean, it does look like a scene out of like Empire Strikes Back, which I think is another reason I sort of took to this movie as a kid. Everyone was dressed like Han Solo. You know, so I mean, they all kind of look like it. Just didn't have the tauntaun to freeze in, you know. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, it is a stark place, though, and we're just thrown right into this movie. That's the other thing, is there's no real setup to any of it. There's no crawl. There's nothing. It's just boom, 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 and then this helicopter shooting at this dog running across the snow, and Kurt Russell's pouring scotch into his computer because it cheats. So, I mean, it's kind of.
And apparently, there was deleted scenes that didn't make the final cut that introduced all the characters, and John Carpenter said, "No way."
That was a good call. Yeah, because I think the first 30 minutes of this, after the opening scene, is nothing but character introduction. Anyway, it would have been too much.
Yeah.
Yeah, his tendency for minimalism really kind of works out here, I think, in a way that it hasn't always worked out for him. I like that we keep talking about the environment that this is shot in, because I think that's one of the things that makes it, one of the things that helps the daytime scenes be as effective as they are, as unnerving as they are, is because this is such a weird looking place. You know, there's nowhere that most people never go to an environment like this. And if they do, it's because, you know, they're being made to go by some sort of nebulous government research grant, or because they want to go look at the Aurora Borealis. But in a lot of ways, Antarctica has a lot of similarity to like the desert, in terms of it being as close to an alien atmosphere on Earth as we're going to get.
And they actually recorded the wind, you know, make it, you know, the sound of the wind on the Antarctic in the desert out in California. So it's sort of ironic.
That's perfect that they used. I didn't know that they had used that, but that makes a ton of sense. Ron, you're making a great point. And I think that's the interesting part here, is you've got an alien being that is pitted against humans that are also in an alien place to them. I mean, there's nowhere else where you can replicate that. Right. And so it becomes, they're fighting against the elements as much as they're doing anything else.
And the elements are hostile to both parties, which I think is really important, because the alien doesn't gain an advantage by going outside and skulking around. It's just as vulnerable to that cold as everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's theorized that when I forgot his name, but Wilford Brimley, when he's going and axing the computer room and the radio room, he's already infected. And so the thing is saying, I don't think I'm getting out of here, so I'm going to go back into hibernation.
Yeah, go ahead and dig back in, right?
So, yeah.
I wanted to ask y'all that because, you know, Blair's turn is a big part of this. That's Wilford Brimley's character. When did you think he was infected? And you, Justin, you said you think it's early on. What about you, Ron?
Yeah, it definitely seems like he's infected really early on. Probably when – I'm going to say it's probably when he's doing that autopsy. I mean, he is wearing gloves, but, man, there is a lot of blood and mysterious pieces going everywhere.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Yeah. They go to the Norwegian camp, and of course it's in ruins, and they find that two-headed corpse, you know, which is such a freaky-looking thing. I mean, just what a... It's almost Giger-esque. Like, it really feels that way, and it's not sexual enough, I guess, but it's still the same kind of idea, but it's just grotesque, but in a way that, like, I want to keep staring at it to figure out how the hell did that happen?
Mm-hmm. And why did they bag it up and bring it back?
Well, these are scientists, man. Like, they're eternally curious. I think that's what we're supposed to believe. I'm with you, though. I do remember. I can't get my wife to watch many of the things we review, but occasionally I can. We've watched this once. She was like, don't touch that. No. Bad juju.
So, you got to pull out your disposable camera, take a few pictures, and then go back to camp.
Yeah, I was like, no. We forget that even existed. So that camp over there, that's their problem.
Do you think it makes a difference that this took place in like 1982 prior to like AIDS?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We didn't talk about communicable disease the way that we do now. Yeah.
When it looks like at some point they're like poking this thing with like their unprotected bare hands.
Oh, yeah. They've got pencils after it and they're sitting there with a coffee mug going like, what do you think, Blair? I mean, non-sterile environment. Completely.
Oh, but the ultimate is at the end when they're doing the blood test and they're using the same scalpel. And I think his name is Windows. He like wipes it off on his sleeve in between, you know, cutting. And I'm like, really? You think one of them is an alien? It can take over your cells and you're cutting everybody with the same knife. Good idea, guy.
I bet you the guy's like, I'm in the cold. Everything's sterile. That's probably what he was thinking. That's the kind of dumb logic I would have used in the Boy Scouts. So.
But, I mean, even in the 80s, hepatitis was a thing.
You think?
Yeah, but maybe not in Antarctica. I don't know. So,
it's too cold to get hepatitis.
It's too cold for the hepatitis. The other thing is, I can write it off as they're so freaked out by what's happening to them, they're not really thinking through the logical steps of stuff. Like, we should just totally quarantine this and not fool with us anymore. But it's too late anyway. By the time that the movie starts, the dog's there. They're infected from the – I mean, they're all dead, basically, from the minute this movie starts. Which, this is another thing, too. And I talk about, you know, the 50s film was a – product of its time and its politics and all that kind of stuff. And I feel like this one is too, because people think of the 80s and they think like, you know, excess and Wall Street and all that kind of stuff. But that was the late 80s. 1982, everything sucked and everybody hated everything. The president had just got shot by somebody who was in love with Jodie Foster. So we were all like trying to figure that out, right? With gas was a price was a mess. We still had problems in Iran. The economy was in the toilet. It sounds kind of like today, but I mean, there was a nihilism to Americana at the time, and I think this movie reflects that.
I think there was a lot of apocalyptic movies at the late 70s and early 80s, so this is very apocalyptic. They're at the end of the world, battling an alien.
Yeah, and those kind of apocalyptic scenarios are definitely like John Carpenter's thing. Yeah. Not the thing, but like a thing John Carpenter likes to do.
Yes, you're right.
But also John Carpenter's the thing.
It works both ways, see? So.
So who do you think was the first one infected?
Well, that's a good one. I'm going to go with Blair, but I could be wrong. I was on your side with that, Justin. I get to say I've always thought he was the thing from the get-go, but... Uh-huh.
Yeah, I could definitely go with Blair as the first one getting infected. It just seems really, you know, either Blair or Clark, because Clark's the one who's hanging out with the dog.
Right.
But remember, he kills Clark at the end and he tests his blood.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's the twisted part of it is that he murders somebody. That's what. That's the moral compass lesson of this is you become so suspicious, you murder somebody, and then, oh, wow, he actually wasn't guilty.
And I absolutely was like, it's Clark the entire time. Even knowing it wasn't him, watching it again, I was like, it's Clark. He was the one that they showed the shadow and the dog goes in the room. It's Clark, you know, just all day long. And Clark's always kind of weird and awkward anyway. So
that's Richard Mazur, I think, though. I mean, he just kind of plays that even when he's not intending to. Like, if, I don't know if you remember the ensemble movie Parenthood, but he's in that as the – I think he's – Lee Phoenix's mother's boyfriend, teacher, something like that. But he's creepy in that too. And he doesn't even intend to be. That's why they gave him the great role in the Stephen King It. He was great as a disembodied head. I mean, he's just a weird kind of dude. He's just got that, I'm a car salesman, but I'm thinking about murdering you in my basement kind of look on his face. That's maybe I've listened to your show too much, Justin. I don't know. But, I mean, that's what he comes off as. But you're right. Like, you're led to believe it's him for so much. And the fact that he gets murdered in all of this is the ironic sadness of all of it.
Well, and you think it's him. And then when the dog is changing, he kicks the cage door closed on the tentacles and then runs and gets, like, an axe. But then he's kind of suspiciously absent from the rest of that scene when they're killing the thing. And so it's so much of a misdirection there. It's brilliant because, again, I thought it was him the entire time. But who was the guy that they actually burn out on the ice whose hand is all, you know, monstrified? Who was that? I forgot the guy's name. Kind of the bald guy.
That wasn't Copper, was
Bennings.
It? Bennings, yes.
Bennings, yes.
See, that's the other thing, too. The ensemble, they all start running together at some point. It's like, the other white guy. No, the other one.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But Bennings could have been the first thing, but then infected somebody else. You know, it's like, who is it?
Can we talk about the fact that Gary Donald Moffat pulls out a pistol and shoots the surviving Norwegian at the beginning of this movie? Just, I mean, I know the guy is speaking in foreign language and firing a weapon at you, but he pulls out that Dirty Harry like nobody's business and just puts the guy down.
Well, it was a mass shooting.
He also shot one of the scientists. So, I mean, are you going to let him get away with that?
I know he doesn't last long enough to get away with much, but yeah. So it is strange though, but I think again that's supposed to show us like people have stress reactions in different paranoid ways, right? And his is to grab his gun.
I was gonna say he always carries it on his hip, so he's always got it. He's like the cowboy.
Yeah, that was a weird thing about him. But speaking of weird, I want to talk about that dog. And how awesome of a performance they get out of that wolf dog.
Yes.
Jed. That's it. The dog's name is Jed.
Yeah. Jed gives an incredible performance. You are right.
Just that one scene where they're pushing him into the kennel and how unnatural he moves and lays there and how undog-like it looks.
Oh, yeah.
Is just disturbing immediately. Like, I immediately start worrying about those dogs every time they kind of kick Jed into that thing, because Jed's clearly not it's a dog, but it's not a dog because it's not doing any dog like things,
right?
Yeah, it's like, so awkward.
It's like the thing doesn't know that creature at all. It's never encountered one of those, so it doesn't know how to act like it. Like when it encounters humans, you don't get the sense this is the first time it's come across them, so it at least has some bit of viral memory of, oh, this is what they do. But maybe it's never found a dog like that, and it's like, I don't know what this thing does. What is it? Does it walk upright? No. You know, it doesn't know what it to do. And I've looked at that always as the thing doesn't know how to act like the dog, so it acts weird.
And is that why Blair ends up killing the dogs with the axe later? Because he's like, you know, I don't need these things anymore. I don't need to absorb them, or if I do absorb with them, then I don't know how to behave and they can find me easier.
See, I think if you go with our theory that he's the thing pretty much the whole time, they're going to give him away at some point. Yeah. And he's like, no, I can take care of those. And it'll also throw suspicion off of me if I actually go and kill one of my replicants.
Yeah.
And the dogs clearly detect the thing and react negatively to it. Mm-hmm. So I think there is something to kind of covering its own tracks.
That's a thing, though, in horror movie tropes, though, right? Like the dogs, the cats usually are evil. Sorry, Ron. But the dogs do usually find, like, they know when something's wrong, right? And they're usually the first alert to a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, they always.
Because, yeah, dogs are more attuned to, like, discomfort, I think. So the dog would sense immediately that one of these guys is decidedly anxious and uncomfortable around the others.
Yeah. I mean, we give dogs these superpowers because they do have superpowers. They can smell anything. They can sense earthquakes before they happen. They, you know, in most movies, they can sense paranormal activity and whatever. And so this isn't anything out of the ordinary for the dog to sense that this is an alien. This is not something that's normal.
And let's not forget how much dogs hate Terminators.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just another point for the dog.
Exactly. That
my dogs hate my Roomba. But my Roomba just fell down the stairs, and I'm thinking, okay, Skynet's never going to happen anytime soon if this stupid robot doesn't know where a ledge is.
We're a few years away, so, but Judgment Day is inevitable, so don't forget. I love how Blair, though, when he's doing his autopsy, talks about that the dead thing is still active on a cellular level or whatever, however he says it. And I'm like, this is interesting because if he's the thing, it's revealing its secrets to them. And I'm wondering, like, does it know, like, well, this is really going to freak them out, you know? or is it just like, well, if I talk science-y, they'll leave me alone? I mean, I wonder what it's trying to do.
It's a good question, because is he infected at that point, or is he infected when they go back and check on him and he says he wants out and he's got the noose there? You know, like maybe he had that noose because he was getting infected, or he was going to take his life before, you know, trying to prevent himself from getting infected. So maybe when he's talking science-y, he still is human, but he gets infected from that. I don't know.
I was going to say, yeah. Is he just paranoid naturally, or does getting infected make him more paranoid?
I think he's paranoid naturally, and I think getting infected makes him more paranoid. Because I think that, as we see throughout the movie, it's not like an instantaneous process where you get bitten by the thing and you turn into the thing or whatever. It's a change on a cellular level, like as we saw with the asteroid Atari graphic computer program that Wilford Brimley's playing with. Like we're supposed to believe Wilford Brimley can use a computer.
That's the same computer program that the Silver Shamrock Corporation has. I just want y'all to know that. It's the same thing, but and works on about the same level. But
and it's the same glider thing when Snake Plissken is flying into New York too.
Yes.
Oh, that's right.
Very good. Yeah. And like the next version of it is whatever the crazy people in Superman 3 had when they were shooting missiles at Superman in the middle of the desert for whatever the hell reason they were doing that. I don't remember. So that movie's awful too. But anyway, I do like, though, that MacReady's the one that I think he's just as paranoid as Blair, but he's able to kind of keep it together because he's all about, we're going to kill it, we're going to destroy it. He's sort of the Chief Brody of Jaws 2 of this. I felt like he was like, nah, we're getting rid of this right now. And I'm like, this guy's a helicopter pilot. So I know helicopter pilots. They're not just like natural, you know, Rambos all of a sudden. You know, I work with one, as a matter of fact. He's one of like the neatest, nicest, nerdiest dudes ever. I can't imagine Frank killing anybody or anything like that. It's so interesting to watch I'm like, MacReady's got to have a heck of a backstory where like he was born in the circus or something and was a truck driver. And I don't know. I mean, he's kind of a MacGyver.
He probably was in Vietnam.
That was his original backstory that they never introduced in the movie, was he was a Vietnam helicopter pilot.
That makes total sense too with the time frame. Yeah.
I mean, he kind of looks like a Vietnam veteran. That's why I think he's off in that shack by himself.
Yeah. The long hair and all of that. Yeah. Half drunk and cursing at his computer chess. So.
Yeah. But they, for whatever reason, they cut that scene of the introductions, and that was supposed to be his backstory. And of course that makes sense. He's drinking his PTSD away and in his own shack away from everyone.
Absolutely. But, and you wonder too, like, what would make somebody take a job like that? Probably to get away from everything. You want to do that? I mean, like, you can go look up the Antarctic research stations now that, like, Rand runs and stuff like that, and they'll flat tell you in the application process, you have to be able to deal with working alone. No, like, really, really alone for long periods of time if you're going to do this, because it's not for everybody. So, and that's nowadays, you know, when we have telecommunication, but even up there, it's still pretty, you know, spotty. But, I mean, they are really cut off from everything up there. You know, it takes forever just to get a rescue signal out.
Do you think Blair's diabetes had anything to do with his response to this thing?
I've never thought about that before.
I mean, it's Wilford Brimley, so he has to be, the character has to be diabetic as well. But do you think, like, you know, blood sugar makes people do weird things? Do you think, like, that might have had some effect on the metamorphosis process, slowing it down so that we could get Blair to give us our science exposition dump before he becomes the ultimate destroyer of radio equipment?
It could be.
Well, now my whole theory of him being infected first is blown out of the water. And when he's got the axe and he's messing up the radio room, he just needed a Snickers, right?
So, yeah. He's hangry. Yeah,
it's the very first Snickers commercial.
How has DirecTV not co-opted that? Oh, he's dead. Never mind. Or else they probably would have. You know, redoing the old commercials. Yeah, I think Wilford Brimley's been gone for a while now. It's, I mean, I've always known him as the old man in That Thing, so I can't imagine he's still with us. I mean, he's still alive. You're right. He's 82. Holy cow! Well, good for you, Anthony Wilford Brimley. So,
but maybe you're actually onto something here, Ron, and I'll explain my logic here. The one guy who his chest opens up and he cuts the guy's arms off. Remember, he was infected for a while and he was kind of slowing down, and then it's like he has a heart attack.
Yeah, Norris has a heart attack. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but obviously he was infected and he wasn't having a heart attack. He was changing into the thing. So maybe Wilford's diabetes was slowing the process down.
Is that the guy who looks like the love child of Meatloaf and Joe Don Baker, right?
Yes. That is excellent casting. So, yes, Charles Hallahan. So
I mean, the thing can take you over fairly quickly, or it can slowly take you over. And with him, with Norris, it was more of a slow takeover.
I like the idea that when it replicates, that it has varying degrees of speed by doing it, and it probably based on the size of the thing, of the person too, or the thing it's taking over, right? The dog's like a little bit smaller, more active.
Or like the complexity of the organism.
Yeah.
And how much of it actually gets into, like, the bloodstream.
Oh, so like if you get more thing in you, there's more, it works faster?
Yeah, like when Blair grabs, what's his name, by the face. Mm-hmm. Like, that seemed to be a pretty quick change process, but I also get the feeling that, you know, Blair rammed a lot of thing tentacles into I forget the guy's name, into his face.
Or when the conspiracy theory guy that was talking about Chariots of the Gods, when he is the first guy he does the blood test on, and then he grabs the other guy and starts eating him through his big mouth head. And then Windows, who's getting eaten, he tosses him aside, and Windows starts changing almost immediately.
Oh, he does. Yeah.
Yeah.
That blood test scene, man, that is one of, like, the best builds of tension in a movie that's full of just nothing but tension anyway. Like, it's so great the way that they, and in spite of all the medical malpractice going on and stuff with the same scalpel and all that, just the you're just waiting for like it to jump at the next one and at the next one. And it's almost like the thing realizes, eh, the gig is up, screw it, and just goes haywire in that room all of a sudden.
Because it's cornered, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it reacts like an animal, which is why MacReady burns both Windows and Palmer at the same time. So,
but then the head escapes for a bit.
Yeah, the running down the hallway. You got to admit, the transformations, at, you know, from the chest eating to the head that bites one off, the head running down, those things look amazing. The effects work in this was transcendental for the time, but good grief, it still holds up. I mean, it looks so good. Justin, you're the big fan of practical effects over CGI effects. Why do you think these hold up?
Because they're just they're so quick that you can't sit there and look at them and see the zippers or something like that. I mean, one of my favorite movies is Dreamscape, but I go back and watch that now and I'm like, yeah, that looks like a rubber mask now. That's stupid.
I rewatched that recently again, by the way. What a trip.
If this is blasphemy, but if they were to ever remake Dreamscape, I would be happy because it was one of my favorite movies and I would hope that they would improve upon it, but they usually don't.
You get the right people, but, they might, but yeah.
But the thing is definitely it sets the bar for practical effects. And I guess I'm so spoiled by this movie that when I watch, you know, The Walking Dead or Game of Thrones today and I see them CGI blood splatter, I'm like, why are you doing that? Just blow up a blood packet, man. It just doesn't take much.
One of the amazing things about this movie is that you're not just getting, you know, Rob Bottin doing all the special effects. You're also getting Stan Winston doing special effects too.
Yeah,
so they had literally two of the best special effects people who have ever lived working on the same movie. And I mean, Stan Winston only did the dog creature, but man, that is a great looking monster.
Well, that and you've got one of the greatest cinematographers of the 20th century, Dean Cundey, shooting it. I mean, I can't say enough about that guy. And just, I mean, the list of things the man has shot and made come to life for us, you know, from Halloween to this to Back to the Future to Jurassic Park. You know, I mean, Dean Cundey made a lot of fake things look very real and very good by being able to cut at the right spot, to light it just the right way. And it was always something different, too. I think that's one thing about him that I always liked is he worked in a lot of different spaces. You know, we talked about the atmosphere of this film and stuff, and there is so much light around it, and it's that you get to see it, but you still can't see the strings. I mean, that's real artistry. But beyond just the, you know, just looking at it and going, God, that looks amazing, it's freaky as hell. I mean, you see somebody's head walking down the hallway. I'm like, no, that is not supposed to happen. So,
and that I think is one of the reasons why the special effects still hold up so well. They don't have to look completely natural. They have to look like a mockery of the human form. Mm-hmm. So you're going to get some uncanny valley-ness that's going to add to the discomfort you feel by watching that head sprout eyeballs and or tentacles or eye stalks and skitter off on gross fleshy spider legs. It kind of looks like a human face, but like horribly distorted by some sort of unnatural, you know, xenomorph parasite thing.
No,
so
you're right. It's alien.
So it doesn't it doesn't have to look. It's not going to look like a person anymore, but it looks enough like a person that you can see that this is like a gross mockery of human flesh. And, you know, David Cronenberg made a whole career on that.
Yes, he did indeed. So we get down to our final four, though, that survived. MacReady, Gary, Knowles, and Childs are the ones that are left. And when the other three find Childs gone, that sets everything else into motion where they're like, we're gonna blow up the ship and take our chances in the shuttle. We're going to blow it to work. And my thought is like, what's the plan here? All the transports are gone. All the dogs are dead. If we just blow it all up, we're going to kill it. But did they ever verbalize the plan to survive? Or is it just like, and then we'll figure it out? Is it like steal underpants and profit? You know?
They said, let's raise the temperature. And I'm like, why? Don't you want it to freeze? It was a really poor plan. But again, this is John Carpenter and everything's got to go out with a big bang. So he's blowing it all up.
Yeah.
Well, I think by the time that there's only four of them left, they realize that they're not going to survive no matter what.
So then it's a decision to save humanity is what you're saying.
Yes, which is why they don't want it to freeze. Because if it freezes, somebody will come and pick it up and take it back to civilization and bury it somewhere.
Or they'll try to weaponize it and sell it or something like that. And then
You have to keep it from freezing and you have to kill it somehow.
Right. So they get all the dynamite in the world lives in Antarctica.
I just didn't get them going room to room. You know, just blowing up everything. I guess maybe they're thinking, I don't know where it's hiding, so we're just going to blow this whole place up. But
that was my thought. I think at that point they had figured out that it can infect you so many different ways. So the only way to really eradicate it is to sterilize the place. And fire's the one thing that does that. So I always took it as they were just blowing up everything behind them so that they could wipe out any remnants.
Yeah, because they do make a point of mentioning contamination and how they should only eat out of cans, et cetera.
Yeah.
Which is funny in the end when Childs and McCready share that drink. We'll talk about that. But, yeah, that goes out the window at that point. But, yeah.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a concern when they were blood testing each other. I guess at that point, they're like, well, the last time we weren't mm-hmm. healthy. Look what happened. So, but no, we get that great showdown though, where Blair becomes that huge monster and attacks and everything. And I'm like, man, I've seen so many movies rip this off in the end now. Like Leviathan is one that comes to mind, where Peter Weller throws dynamite at the really crappy monster and stuff. And this is the only time when I look at it and I'm like, okay, that one doesn't look as good as some of the other ones. Like I'll ding the effects in the end because when it goes into Godzilla mode, it doesn't really work as well.
It's funny you said Leviathan because I was thinking Tremors.
Oh, that's a good one. Can you fly, sucker, fly line then?
Because, so. In Tremors, they're under the ground, but you see the ground bubbling up. And at the end of the thing, it's all those planks are just getting shot up into the air as it's coming forward and nothing's going to stop it. So, yeah.
I credit a lot of that to the barrels and jaws and how that was the standard way to build when something was coming after you at that point. It was, you didn't have to show it till it was right on top of you.
Yeah.
To me, it kind of reminds me of the trap they set for the thing in The Thing from Another World, where they've got where they set up the electrical trap using the generator.
Yeah,
they have to
set up
stand on the pieces of wood.
Yeah,
to not electrocute themselves. It kind of made me think of that for whatever reason.
That's a good point.
Was that a nod at the end of John Carpenter's thing when he says, "Where's the generator?" and they say it's gone?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Carpenter loves that movie. I mean, that's what drove him to want to do this anyway. He was thinking about it when he was doing Halloween. That's why he got the clearance rights to put it all over those, TV sets and stuff in there. So, I could see that completely. That makes sense. But we do get down to the final big explosions. McCready triggers the big blast, and everything's blown away. And I want to ask you guys about the end here, because I go back to my theme again about the early 80s and the nihilism of the times. Like, this is a serious downer ending. Like, this is where we're telling the audience, nope, everybody's going to die. And this is also interesting that the alien is like, fuck it, I'll get drunk with you too. You know, I mean, I think Childs is the alien and McCready's like, yeah, okay, I'm just going to wait until I freeze to death and then you can freeze here too, you son of a bitch.
I have problems because there's that whole theory of the eye light. What is it? Like the eye flare?
Oh yeah. The glimmer.
And so if you're human, you have a glimmer in your eye. And if you're the thing, you don't. And, John Carpenter even goes so far as to say, well, if you're looking at their breath, McCready's breathing, cause you can see the breath in the cold air.
Right.
And Childs, you don't see his breath. But meanwhile, Childs has an earring in his ear. So it's like, okay, well, is he changing into the thing, so he's still child, or is he already the thing, but then he wouldn't have the earring because the thing doesn't take jewelry.
and they play with that in the prequel too. There's another bit with that, with the ear, it winds up on the wrong ear or something, if memory serves. But
so I got problems with that, because I'm thinking, okay, in the eye flare, that doesn't happen anywhere else in the movie. And it's so subtle in that final scene that I'm like, I can't make sense out of this.
I feel like that is like, we're watching it so frame by frame, and we found a thing to just latch onto. That's Texas sharpshooter fallacy, where we just shoot the hell out of the barn and then we find the best grouping and paint the target around it. You know, that's what that feels like to me. Okay, Rod, you weigh in. You've heard us chatter about it.
I don't know if the thing's powers allow it to grow earrings, because it clearly has clothes on. It creates clothing, but I don't know if it created like buttons and zippers and stuff like that, or just stuff that looked like clothes.
I guess you're right. There, it does create clothing, because it shreds out of their clothes and then it looks like them again with clothes. So it's why kinda, couldn't it do?
Yeah, it's kind of T-1000-y that way, you know. It could do everything except moving parts, maybe. I don't know. That's an interesting thought. You can look at it a lot of ways. One is Childs is the thing, and MacReady's just like, yeah, we'll just wait this out, and they, you know, share some gasoline or whatever they're drinking together, J&B. Or they're neither the thing, but neither one of them are going to trust each other, because how the heck can you at that point? And they're like, yeah, we'll just sit out here and freeze to death then.
See, I always leaned really heavily towards the neither one of them is the thing, but there's so much mistrust between the two of them that they've just decided, well, let's sit here until we die.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's even if Childs is the thing, that they might just freeze to death. Like it might not even kill MacReady or whatever is Mac, because it's like, I don't need to even kill you, because you're going to freeze to death. And then if I freeze too, it'll just look like two guys froze to death, and then it won't be as suspicious if I tear you apart.
Yeah, so if I sit here, I can go dormant, freezing in this body, and then when they come and pick us up, well, then that's when I can propagate, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways to look at it.
It's back to a situation where it benefits more by hiding what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So it's not going to reveal itself needlessly, as we, you know, discovered throughout the movie.
Yeah, I mean, well, and that's the thing about this movie and about the alien that is so neat, is that it changes its MO as the situation changes, and then it ultimately comes back to where it was to begin with. It's like, hey, maybe I'll just wait it out, because even if it's not one of them, it's somewhere around there. So yeah, it's sitting over in the corner going, which one? Maybe I'll just wait them both out, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and there's they put all the fires out so fast that there's corpses of it laying all over the camp, that it's going to come back even if it's not Childs.
It's definitely an Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru situation, whoever rolls in the next morning and sees all that, right? They're like, ooh, yeah. You know, that's a, I don't know what would even become of that. Because, look, this is a government facility. They're not just going to leave it sitting there. It might take them a while to get there, but you know they're coming.
Yeah.
Or if they're not, the Russians who are spying on us are going to come over and check it out, right? Like, that would have been the sequel, the Russian thing.
Oh, yeah, the Russian thing.
Yeah, so the sequel that never happened, but...
See, this is Dolph Lundgren coming back as the as the MacReady role.
That would have been awesome. So,
so that's why Ivan Drago was able to fight Rocky so well. He was actually a thing.
That's Wow, we've tied these franchises together.
Yes, we've really created the thing expanded universe here.
I'm telling you, it's pretty amazing. But, well, guys, I think we're at the point of the podcast where it's time to give final thoughts, recommendations, and Justin, we do popcorn ratings here, so extra large to small and burnt. We'll ask you first, what is your popcorn ratings and final thoughts for John Carpenter's The Thing?
Oh, you know I'm going with extra large, with butter. It's one of my favorites, and I can't think of another. I mean, Alien and Aliens, two of my all-time favorite kind of sci-fi horror movies, but The Thing is so different, so creative. I mean, I could never think of crab spider legs coming out of a head and then, you know, running off in any other movie. It just doesn't happen. So there it is.
Ron?
Oh yeah, definitely extra large popcorn. I love them. I love any movie where a guy catches on fire and you see the stuntman wandering around the scene while on fire. And John Carpenter is basically the master of that thing, because I mean, he's got it in The Thing. He's got it in
the end of Halloween 2.
Halloween 2. He's got it in, I think there's somebody on fire in The Fog, maybe.
I think so. There's somebody on fire in They Live at some point. So
yeah, there's somebody on fire in Big Trouble in Little China.
Yep.
So yeah, John Carpenter is Mr. Let's Light Some People on Fire and Let Them Wander Around. And I think it's great. Extra large popcorn with butter, with the fancy big thing of flavoring salt you can sprinkle on top of it. Open up a thing of chocolate covered peanuts and dump it in there. It's just top notch. There's a reason The Thing is one of the most well regarded horror movies in this day and age, and it holds up. It's as good now as it was in 1982, if not maybe better. Because we've seen other people try to do this thing and fail so badly at making this kind of movie that it makes the original look all the more impressive.
Yeah.
I can't augment much of what you guys said. I agree with every bit of it. Such a large popcorn. I'll say this. Halloween is one of my top five films of all time, no doubt. But if you were to ask me what's John Carpenter's best stuff, I'm going to tell you it's The Thing. It's his best made film. I think top to bottom, even with the problems in it. We picked some of it, you know, here and some of the nitpicking of it. But even that is minuscule compared to how good this movie is and how well it still works. I mean, we're talking about it 35 years later, guys, which now that makes me feel really old. but I mean, if we're talking about it decades later and it still works. And to the point that when they tried to redo it in 2011, they got close. But nobody talks about that movie. People are still talking about this one. And that's how you know you've got something that's not only cult classic, but it's timeless. And I think when it's all said and done for Carpenter, you know, he'll go down as Halloween and The Thing. But I think if you really ask folks to divide between the two, I think The Thing's the better film.
I still have, you know, a special place in my heart for Escape from New York and his other works. But The Thing is the serious, this is you knocking it out of the park. And Halloween. And I even liked Halloween too. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
Oh, yeah. I'm a fan of the whole series. You go back and listen to the whole thing, folks. I'll make apologies for Halloween 6. It's a lot of fun. So, but not part 5. So, but Justin, thanks so much for joining us on Film Cert, man. It's been an absolute blast. Tell folks how they can find your podcast and check out your stuff.
Oh, the Generation Y, all spelled out. The words, we're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We probably even have a Tumblr out there that I don't even know about. And then peripheral, just regular places you can listen to podcasts, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Music, all those places. So cool.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for being with us, Ron. Folks can follow your work over at Den of Geek, right?
Yes, Den of Geek. The Walking Dead's coming back fairly soon. They're trying to talk me into picking Fear the Walking Dead back up. I don't know if that's going to be a successful attempt on their part or not. I'm there usually 2 to 3 times a week.
Absolutely. Folks, of course, you can find our podcast, continuousplaypodcast.com/movies. Subscribe to us wherever you get your podcast, Continuous Play Podcast-Filmstrip. You can also check out our side projects where we sit around and talk about sports, Continuous Play Podcast-Sports as well, and catch up with the rest of the gang. We do appreciate your support. If you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes or Google Play. It helps other people find the show and tell other folks about it. Again, Justin, thanks again for joining us. For Ron, I'm Jay. Thanks for listening to Filmstrip.
Thank you for listening to Filmstrip. You can find more episodes on our website, continuousplaypodcast.com/movies. Please leave us a positive review on iTunes and link up with us on Facebook. The Filmstrip theme music is produced and performed by Frozen Lake 121.